climate time bomb is ticking. But today's IPCC report is a how-to guide to defuse the climate time bomb. It is a survival guide for humanity. As it shows, the 1.5 degree limit is achievable. But it will take a quantum leap in climate action. This report is a clarion call to massively fast-track climate efforts by every country and every sector and on every time frame.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres talking about the new UN climate report in the most definitive report released by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This report warns that we are nearing catastrophic levels of global warming and irreversible damage within the next decade. It also says there's still time to avoid it, but to do so, the world needs to collectively cut emissions in half by 2030. So in less than 7 years. Joining me now to talk about whether that's possible is Edward Parson, environmental law professor and faculty director of the UCLA Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. Hi, Ted.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. So they whittled down all of this data into 30 odd pages. What are the key takeaways?
Well, it's hard to find key takeaways because the language has a lot of complexity and ambiguity. And I was actually a little astonished at the quote from the clip from the Secretary General that you led just a moment ago, saying we have one last chance to avoid 1.5C, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit heating above pre-industrial levels. That's the first of the two politically agreed targets in the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. And is often identified as a threshold of very severe damages from climate change. Because my reading of the report is that it actually says the world will pass 1.5C probably within about 10 years. And
if we do, whether we do anything or not, it's just baked in?
Yeah, pretty much. It's, you know, it's a... the lags and momentum of the system are huge. It's steering a super tanker. So you can mm-hmm. Pull as hard as you want on the rudder and it takes a long time to turn. So the UN body that issued this report is very careful not to make categorical statements, certainly in their headline statements. But in fact, if you read the text even of the 30-page summary for policymakers, which is what was released in the middle of the night here, you know, in West Coast time, it pretty much says the world will pass 1.5C, which is the first of the Paris targets. That's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit global average heating over pre-industrial levels. And the stakes are all in how far we go beyond that. I mean, there's huge priority on intensive efforts to cut emissions as soon as possible. In my view, and in my reading of this report, it doesn't say that that will suffice to keep the world below 1.5C, but that doesn't mean it's not an imperative to do it. It's 1.5C isn't a cliff beyond mm-hmm. which all is lost and we all just, you know, curl up in fetal position and gather with our loved ones and wait to die.
Yeah.
1.5 is a politically demarcated boundary beyond which things get worse and worse and worse incrementally, especially for the most vulnerable people and regions of the world. So
we're already seeing that though right now. As we speak, yet another atmospheric river is on the way here in California. So aren't we already seeing the results?
You are so right. I mean, so when I say 1.5C, I keep talking in Celsius and of course, I should say 2.7F. It's not that everything's fine up until that and then we basically fall off a cliff into hell beyond that. It's that things are getting worse and worse and worse in a progressive incremental way up until that point, and they keep getting worse beyond that. So yeah, the disruptions, the crazy weather in the winters, the crazy fire seasons, the extended droughts, the most recent example that you'd think would have really hammered home just how bad things might be are the floods in Pakistan last mm-hmm. monsoon season.
Which really weather. Highlights the biggest problem here is, as you mentioned, that vulnerable people, the poor people of the world, are most at risk.
Yes, absolutely. So it's not that rich people in rich countries are not at risk. Everyone's at risk. But always the vulnerabilities are greatest for the most mm-hmm. disadvantaged people, which in the climate change context, that mostly means low latitude, low elevation, low income countries. So small islands and coastal regions. Yep.
Right.
Go ahead.
One of the results of all of this that they're saying is likely now is no more Arctic sea ice in the summertime.
There's still a lot of controversy over how fast that will happen. If it keeps getting hotter, then it's essentially assured that there will be no more Arctic sea ice in the summer. It's greatly reduced already. There's still a range of projections of how fast it will continue to disappear. And that's something that is likely to have really severe kind of worldwide disruptions as a consequence.
What does that look like? For example, here in the United States, on the coast of California, on the East Coast, along the southern coasts, what does it look like?
So here you're moving a little beyond my expertise, because and I want to say there's actually a fair amount of controversy over specific regional consequences of climate change. So the reason people often talk in sort of general terms the way I'm now, it's like, you know, things are going to get worse in general, more extremes, hot, actually even cold in some instances as well, wet and dry. Interacting effects is that the further you go down the chain of consequences toward projecting, you know, what will this mean for Los Angeles storms in the winter, the more uncertainties get thrown in. So it's kind of a hard message to convey the degree of alarm because you don't know specifically what's going to happen.
Right.
So yeah, in terms of Arctic sea ice, it's Arctic sea ice is crucial for the worldwide circulation of ocean currents. So it has very, very long distance dynamical effects in weather and climate worldwide.
I guess the problem with releasing these reports every so often and of holding these conferences every so often is that it does become abstract for the average person. The weather is obviously not abstract. We're dealing with it every day. But what is happening on the more on the higher levels with governments? How are they responding to these reports? And I mean, we just saw President Biden approve a massive oil drilling program in Alaska. So how are governments reacting to this dire news from the UN?
So there's a wide range of how different governments are reacting. Some are on a kind of a five alarm fire, and some are much less. The United States, in the Biden administration, has actually done pretty well relative to all the constraints they're operating under, with the massive turn to huge investment and subsidy programs under recent the Infrastructure and the Inflation Reduction Act. They're taking an approach of basically subsidizing the good new stuff we need to move to, as opposed to regulating and suppressing the bad old stuff we need to move away from.
Is that going to work? Is that enough?
What's enough? It's not going to hold us below 1.5 C, but at this point, there's probably nothing that could be done that would hold us below 1.5 C. It's absolutely imperative to, you know, steer the ship as fast as possible. At this point, I mean, the IPCC didn't quite say it in this report, but a number of recent reports have said it. Basically, investment in new infrastructure for the production, processing, and distribution of fossil fuels, oil and gas and coal, basically has to stop, because that tap has to be turned off. There's actually already more production infrastructure in these fuels than can be fully used and stay within the 1.5 or even the 2-degree Paris targets. So I very much wish the Biden administration was more aggressive in going after current sources of emissions rather than just subsidizing the new energy systems we need.
Okay.
But what they're doing is actually, it's a lot better than we've had.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, my pleasure, bye-bye.
That's Edward Parson, environmental law professor and faculty director of the UCLA Emmett Institute. lab leak or animal market. People are divided over where COVID-19 came from. But now there's new evidence bolstering the market theory. A team of international researchers that analyzed samples of genetic data from the Wuhan market has linked COVID to an animal called a raccoon dog. This comes 3 years after the virus first infected the world and killed nearly 7 million people. Here to tell us more about what a raccoon dog actually is and the science behind this latest theory is Molly Olmsted, staff writer at Slate. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. All right, so this came out recently, even though this disease has been around for, as I said, at least 3 years. So why now? Why is this coming to the fore at this moment?
Well, there was just a study that was done, an analysis that found that there was some genetic material that was taken from the central market that has been of concern in this whole story, that found genetic material for COVID, as well as a significant amount from the raccoon dog. And while it's not exactly a slam dunk by any means, it seems to point pretty heavily towards the idea that it was a zoonotic origin of the disease, that it came from these animals at a market rather than sort of lab leak situation.
And what's the evidence?
It's basically just samples that they took that found that there was just a bunch of this sort of commingling of this genetic material, that there was plenty of raccoon dog genetic material there that sort of was in the same sample. It does not show that there were any infected raccoon dogs definitively. It just means that there is a link there, which had not really been found so strongly before.
So is it sort of like there's evidence that the virus was where the raccoon dog was kept at this market? The raccoon dog is known to be able to get the disease and pass it on. So therefore, the suspicion is that the disease came from the raccoon dog. There isn't like a smoking gun, if you will. There isn't one raccoon dog that they found with the virus in it.
Right. There's no smoking gun. And I don't think we know that definitively the raccoon dog can get COVID, but we do know that it can carry coronaviruses. So okay, it seems like it would make sense that it could carry COVID. And it just sort of points to the idea that this is a place where it easily could have been transferred over to humans, because you do have humans in very close contact with wildlife, wildlife where COVID is known to have been. So it makes sense, but it's, yes, not a smoking gun.
All right, which gets us to the question that I have been wondering, what is a raccoon dog?
Well, in my opinion, the raccoon dog is an extremely cute animal, though opinions vary. But it's not at all a raccoon or a dog. It's closely related, well, not super closely, but its closest relation is a fox. But it does look just like a doggy raccoon. It's kind of wild. I think, you know, this is an animal that we aren't familiar with in the U.S. I don't know any people who'd really heard of it before, but it's a bit of a pest in parts of Europe and a fairly common animal in Asia, in that it has sort of a cultural imprint there. But it's just this cute little guy who just looks like a tall raccoon and lives in sort of wet forest lands where you have heavy undergrowth. And it has the, despite not really being closely related to a raccoon, it has the raccoon's sort of ability to adapt to environments, in that it will eat just about whatever and is pretty good at surviving. And it's not like an aggressive animal. It's just like a big, funny looking raccoon.
Hmm. Okay. And it's sold for its meat. Do people eat it? It's sold for its fur.
It's primarily sold for its fur. In fact, the Humane Society of the U.S., I believe, found that clothing that was marketed as faux fur was actually using raccoon dog fur, like real fur. And that was a bit of a scandal. But it's quite popular for its fur. that would be the main market for it. There is a secondary and much smaller market for the raccoon dog as an exotic pet, but that's been banned in a lot of places and it does not make for a good pet. So you really got to be determined if you want to own one. But yes, just a big fur market.
All right. And so this is the theory right now. Only a couple of weeks ago, the big theory was COVID came from a lab when the Energy Department released its low confidence report saying that it might have come from a lab. Why so many confusing origin stories?
I mean, it's just so hard to figure out. You do have the additional problem of China not being fully cooperative here. I think, you know, the FBI was more inclined to believe it was lab leak. And, you know, some part of me wonders if that has something to do with the particular role the FBI plays, whereas you have other government agencies saying, you know, it's probably more likely to be the markets. It's heavily politicized, obviously, which is making this whole thing very messy. So you have a ton of people out here where no matter what, they're probably not going to be dissuaded from believing it's a lab leak, in part because they've already bought into conspiracy theories, and in part because it gives them a good bad guy to blame, which is not to say the lab leak theory is, you know, wrong. It just means that it has a certain appeal that the, you know, the market theory does not have for a certain segment of the population. So the politics are making all of this, what should be just a scientific debate, into this messy cultural thing. And the reality is we just still don't really know anything.
Molly Olmsted, staff writer at Slate, thank you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this.
Coming up, Wyoming is the first state to ban abortion pills. We'll find out whether that's legal next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. On Friday, Wyoming became the first state to ban the use of pills for abortions. Drugs like mifepristone and misoprostol are the most common way to end a pregnancy. They account for more than half of all abortions in this country. And as I've talked about many times on the show with my next guest, restricting medication is the latest battleground in the fight over abortion ever since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last summer. It's Monday, so that guest is here now, our legal Loyola Law School professor, Jessica Levinson. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
This law takes effect July 1st. What does it do?
That's exactly right. Well, it does what you said. It will make it illegal to prescribe, dispense, distribute, sell, or use any drug for the purpose of performing an abortion. And notice it says any drug. It doesn't call out the two drugs that you just mentioned, because in an earlier version, they actually were going to list the names of the drugs. Doctors said, well, at least one of those drugs has another purpose, so please don't do that. And those in favor of the ban said, actually, we're worried that people will just change the name of these drugs. So now it just uses this generic pills used to perform abortions.
And the punishment is a $9,000 fine and up to 6 months in prison. So for doctors, I suppose, for pharmacists, those are people who prescribe and dispense. But also, as you said, use in the language, it says it's illegal to use any drug for the purpose of performing an abortion. So would that include the pregnant person?
So the law does explicitly say that the pregnant patients are exempt from charges and penalties. And that is in some cases what we're seeing in states. You know, there have been about 500 bills since the Dobbs decision at the end of June. And what we're seeing in at least some of those cases is that the states carve out an exception for the pregnant person, but not for everybody else who assists.
All right. So that means that someone could still get medication abortion through the mail. right? Or go out of state.
So I think the second part of your question is right, could go out of state. Now the mail, I pause for a minute because I will say that I think is a new frontier that we're seeing. Texas is pushing the limits on that, for instance, where they're explicitly passing laws that say, don't mail any abortion pills into the state. And they're also trying to block websites from providing women with any information about getting those abortion pills, either through the mail or traveling out of state to do so. So I pause for a minute because, as you and I have talked about since the Dobbs decision, it really creates more legal questions than it answers. And I think one of those big questions will be, can states ban travel outside? Can states try and ban mailing inside the state?
Well, so inside this state, is this current law, is it legal?
Well, under the federal constitution, I think the answer is yes. Again, because of the Dobbs decision, because the Supreme Court, for I think the first time, said that fundamental right that we said existed in the constitution, that right to obtain an abortion, actually it's not there. And if it's not there, then states can do what they want, with this caveat: states can do what they want as long as the laws don't violate the state constitutions. And so Wyoming, like some other states, has provision in the state constitution that potentially calls these bans into question. Wyoming has a provision that talks about the freedom to make healthcare decisions, for instance. And I think that provision will be at play when we think about this abortion pill ban and a broader ban that Wyoming has tried to enact on all abortions that includes abortion pills.
So they have a provision, as you just mentioned, that allows people to make their own healthcare decisions. And that would presumably be in conflict with this, with this current law?
I would say there's a good argument that that would be in conflict. But Wyoming is doing something that I think legally is clever. And they've done this explicitly with respect to the total abortion ban. So moving from what we are talking about, which is the ban on abortion pills, that separate bill, to moving on and talking about what they've now tried to do two times, which is a total ban on abortion. The first time they tried to do that, the Wyoming state judges said that violates that constitutional provision we've been talking about, that state constitutional provision that you have the freedom to make healthcare decisions. Wyoming then came back and with its second try, they said, well, abortion is not a healthcare decision. So they explicitly tried to carve abortion out. The question is whether or not that will be successful. Can they just, by saying it's not healthcare, will the state courts say, okay, it's not healthcare? Or will they say, you can say whatever you want, but it's still healthcare?
Interesting. So there are legal challenges already being teed up, even though this law is, you know, barely a couple days old.
Exactly. So for the total ban, again, their second attempt at the total ban, the governor actually said, I'm not signing that. I'm going to let it go into law without my signature because it's already in litigation. And so it's his way of allowing it to go into effect, but not blessing it with his signature. And the plaintiffs in that, again, the first total abortion ban case, immediately filed and said, no, stop this second try, stop this new law. And I think their arguments will be substantially similar. Again, the idea that you can say something's not healthcare, but just stating it doesn't necessarily make it so. So absolutely expect litigation both on the separate abortion bill ban and then on that total ban, which has very small carve-outs for rape, incest, and I think they phrase it as the dire healthcare needs of the pregnant person.
All right. So meanwhile, we talked about there this federal court case in Texas, which could affect the entire country. So how would this fit in with that?
Right, because the puzzle pieces never end when it comes to this litigation. So the case in Texas deals with whether or not a judge will issue a nationwide injunction and say the FDA has to revoke approval for mifepristone, which is one of the two abortion pills, and it was approved initially 23 years ago in 2000. if the judge does that, then at least temporarily, it could be the case that nobody in any state could have mifepristone. I will say to people who are listening, it is possible that pharmacies could provide mifepristone without FDA approval. So I hate to say it, but again, more questions than answers.
Mm-hmm. All right. Jessica Levinson, our regular legal eagle here on Press Play. She teaches at Loyola Law School. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new model of incarceration for California's oldest prison, San Quentin. The governor wants it to look like prisons in Norway.
The whole point of the Scandinavian model is to turn out good neighbors, is to give people the skills and the opportunities they need so that they will not come out and create more victims.
That story coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Governor Gavin Newsom wants to reimagine what prison looks like here in California. He spoke Friday from the infamous San Quentin State Prison in Marin County, where he unveiled a plan to transform the state's oldest prison into a rehab center, one inspired by prisons in Scandinavian countries like Norway.
We want to be the preeminent restorative justice facility in the world. That's the goal. San Quentin is iconic. San Quentin is known worldwide. If San Quentin can do it, it can be done anywhere else.
The idea is to make San Quentin a place that fosters good behavior rather than enforce punishment. A few other prisons in the United States have experimented with similar models, but not to this scale. And here to tell us more is Anita Chabrier, columnist for the LA Times, where she's been writing about this. Hello.
Hello.
Well, first, let's talk about San Quentin and get a lay of the land. This is, as I mentioned, the state's oldest prison, opened in the mid-19th century. And it's pretty notorious. Lots of infamous, famous, whatever, prisoners were there, like Sirhan Sirhan, Charles Manson. Give us a little background on San Quentin and why the governor wants this prison to be the model for his reform agenda.
Well, I think there's a couple interesting reasons. First, it is an infamous prison. It's iconic. You know, almost anywhere you go in America, if you say San Quentin, it draws up images for people. And it was our death row where we did keep Charles Manson and others, as you pointed out, for so long. So it really does mean something in the American psyche. And I think that the governor is aiming for a big statement with this and chose San Quentin for that reason. But also, interestingly, San Quentin is our most progressive prison in the state because it is in an urban area and a wealthy area. It's been able to create more programming and more opportunities for prisoners than nearly any other prison in the state. And so it already very much is on a progressive trajectory that the governor is going to capitalize on with this new move.
Right. It has a junior college inside the prison, I understand.
It does. It has a junior college. It has a tennis team. It has, a wonderful newspaper. So it really is. There's a lot happening in San Quentin.
All right. And what does the governor want to do? What is his plan? What would it look like if he transformed it into something that looked like a prison in Norway?
I think that that's where it gets so complicated and why I went out to Pennsylvania to visit a prison that is already doing this, because it sounds so nebulous to say we're going to turn it into a rehab facility. But what I saw when I went to Chester, the prison in Pennsylvania, was just a completely different model of incarceration and one that really focused on how guards and the inmates interact. So right now in our prison system, there is a hard, hard line between prisoners and guards. They're not supposed to fraternize. They don't really interact. It's about control. And in Chester and in the Scandinavian model, that gets flipped on its head. And the guards really are more about being mentors. And so they're the direct connect to services and help. They sit down and have meals with them. They talk to them. They have a relationship with those people. And that's sort of the heart of the Scandinavian model, as opposed to just having the guards be there for control.
Would this be for every prisoner, like even hardened murderers, criminals? Would they be in the system in under the governor's plan?
So the governor did say during the announcement that it would include what we call violent crime. And that's actually a very important part of the Scandinavian model. And in the prison that I visited in Pennsylvania, people who were able to participate in this program were chosen by lottery. So it's not a system that is a reward for good behavior. The idea is that everyone can be successful in this model, regardless of what that crime was.
And you spoke with someone named Luis. You didn't give his last name, or you couldn't, weren't allowed to give his last name, who is incarcerated in Chester, Pennsylvania. Tell us a little bit about his story and how he views his experience.
You know, Luis was convicted on a murder charge when he was 16 years old, and he was given a life sentence, no possibility of parole. As he put it, he didn't even really understand what that meant at age 16. But during his time in prison, he, you know, has really worked on himself. He worked in the program there where they train dogs and really turned his life around. And he went in the lottery for this program. And, you know, it's just a calmer place is the way I can describe it. There's exercise equipment. There's telephones so that he can be in contact with his son, who he had when he was 14. He's able to work with the guards and work on getting job training and things like that. And he really feels like this has given him the opportunity that when he gets out, he will have both the social, emotional, and job skills to be successful and to not return to prison.
And I guess that's the general idea, right? That this is about rehabbing people to eventually return to the outside world and not return to a life of crime, to be productive citizens.
The one thing I would hope that people understand about this is not about the prisoners. It's about communities and it's about public safety, because we have incredibly high recidivism rates in California. People come out and they commit crimes again, often because they don't have job opportunities, housing opportunities. There's a lot of reasons for that. But the whole point of the Scandinavian model is to turn out good neighbors, is to give people the skills and the opportunities they need so that they will not come out and create more victims, and our communities will then be safer.
And that sounds great until you come across someone like Anders Breivik in Norway, the guy who gunned down 69 people, mostly teenagers, at that summer camp. And he was given 21 years. I think viscerally Americans would react negatively to that, saying only 21 years for such a heinous crime. And also being in a prison that looks relatively cush compared to our standards. Morally, is that defensible?
Well, I think you have to look at the bigger picture. So I'm a mom. There are plenty of crimes that I have very little forgiveness for in my heart, right? Like, I don't come at this as, oh, everyone can be rehabilitated. There's plenty of predators in the world, and we have to take that into account. And so there are going to be people who, you know, we as a society decide need to be locked up for perhaps life. But the fact is that the majority of people, the vast majority of people who go into prison are going to come out again. They're there on crimes that are not, you know, mass shootings or don't involve harming children or things like that. So they're coming back out to our communities, whether you like it or not. And it has to be, in my opinion, a public safety conversation. Do you want them to come out with the skills and the opportunities that they have an option other than crime? Or do you believe that prison should just be ongoing suffering and they come out like they went in, or maybe worse, and the chips fall where they fall? And I think that that's something we have to look at beyond the crime a lot of the times and look at what's best for our communities.
And interestingly, you note that the union representing corrections officers is in favor of this proposal, which, you know, on the face of it, you might not expect that they would be in favor of something like this.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I talked to guards in Pennsylvania. I've talked to guards in all over the place. And here in California, I talked to the guards union. And they are 100% for this, as long as it's done right and done carefully and done smartly. And the reason for that is guards have a terrible job. The suicide rate for corrections officers is 39% higher than for all other professions. They're under more stress. When they retire, they have shorter lifespans after retirement than other professions. This is not a job that is treating its workforce well. And so the prison guards union looks at this and sees not just a way perhaps to do greater public safety, but to change the job for corrections guards in a way that will help them to have better outcomes and better futures.
Okay, so when is this transformation going to occur?
Well, that's, you know, you got to go off, talk to the governor. 2025 is the year that they're hoping to have it all happen. This is a major, not just cultural, it's a major cultural shift and a major construction project and a major infrastructure project. So this is no small endeavor. Right now, this is very much an aspiration rather than an actual plan. So we'll see, maybe 2025, but it may take a longer time than that.
Anita Chabrier, columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll celebrate the first day of spring and the first day of the Persian New Year, Nowruz, with music. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. At exactly 2:24 this afternoon, the Persian New Year begins. It happens when the sun crosses the equator, the official end of winter. This moment is called the vernal equinox. The holiday is known as Nowruz, and it means new day. Nowruz celebrates spring, new beginnings. There's lots of good food and good music. That's the song Sornaye Nowruz by the Iranian musical group Rostak. It's one of the most popular songs for the holiday. Nowruz has been celebrated for more than 3,000 years. And in countries far beyond Iran that were once part of the Persian Empire, from the Balkans all the way to Mongolia. So hundreds of millions of people around the world celebrate today. And one of them is our very own KCRW DJ, Nasir Nasirzadeh. And he's brought some music to help us welcome in the new year. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too. Thank you so much for having me, Madeline. Really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh, it is my pleasure. All right, so tell us about this song by Rostak and how it figures into the holiday.
It's a traditional song going way back, as you mentioned. It's over 3,000 years this holiday. So over the years, you know, we've heard the original version of this, but over the last few years or several years, we've heard this beautiful new recording from this contemporary folk ensemble called the Rostak. It's actually a 12-minute long song, and it constitutes the six different regions of Iran and five or more dialects. So that song is broken out into different parts depending on which region you're in. So it's absolutely a great way to celebrate all of the rich culture within Iran. And it's not quite like those, like, you know, epic pop jams that we'll hear like at the beginning of our new year or anything. But it's a beautiful way to celebrate the rich history of Iran.
Mm. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about your history? You are Iranian American and you were born here in the United States.
Yes, absolutely. I'm first generation Iranian American. I was born in Panorama City here in Los Angeles. But my parents actually emigrated to the States right after the Iranian Revolution. They actually were living in Iran at the time, and they were visiting some family in Europe, in London. And as soon as they were there in London, the revolution in 1979 happened. Hmm. So they didn't really go back there, and they decided to take a trip to San Diego because my dad's brother in-law and my dad's sister, who had already kind of been out here, and they've mentioned such great things about Southern California. So, you know, they decided to take a trip and they never really went back. So they came here with absolutely nothing, started a business, kind of like the version of Soup Exchange before it was called a Salad Bowl in San Diego. And it makes me very proud to see the sacrifice they went through in order for us to, you know, be able to be here today.
Hmm. Why did they think they couldn't go back?
Well, it just was, it wasn't a very safe, you know, time to be back there during all the turmoil of the revolution. And they kind of were just looking for something safer for their children and everyone. And they'd already, I think word had already spread at that time that, you know, Southern California was a really great place. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I still have never been to Iran. So it's all a little bit of a mystery to me, but I do my best to, you know, just soak up the culture, especially with my mm-hmm. children too, and just appreciate it, especially through traditions like Nowruz.
Right. And so you have a lot of company here in Los Angeles. So this is a good place.
We do. Yeah. That. Luckily, you know, Los Angeles is almost like the second capital. We call it Tehrangeles. So it's a very rich community here. And, I think everyone, whenever I say I'm Iranian, they always say that, oh yeah, I know some Persian words, some of them, you know, some of the curse words or whatever, but like everyone has someone that they know that's Iranian out here. So it's not a completely foreign place. And it's been really great to come here with a lot of other first generation Iranian Americans that have similar kind of stories than mine.
Okay, let's play another song. This is by the Iranian pop star Andy.
من بهار میاد، گل به سبز زار میاد، در اومد جوونه ها، دلم پر از بهونه ها، بعد از اون جدایی ها عشق به من گفت که بیا، عشق به من گفت که بیا.
Okay, tell us about this song and tell us about Andy. Who's Andy?
Andy obviously is almost like a Madonna or a Gugush, basically, where you can kind of just go by that name and Iranians all over will know who they are. He's one of the biggest Iranian pop stars, actually the first one to receive a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. This song in particular, I just something about it has always struck me. It was played at my wedding, and I think it kind of goes back to a little bit about what we were just speaking about, my parents' journey immigrating here. You know, this song is called Doram Miram Be Tehran. So it's talking about going to Iran for the new year, for Nowruz, and just returning home, and how much he missed his country and the smell of the alleys and the neighborhood. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, great imagery and poetry in the song, but it's just a really nice pop song. But to me, it's like the nostalgia for something that I haven't experienced. Like, I know there will be one day when I do go to Iran, and I just have this, like, image in my head of me being in a car traveling through probably a lot of traffic, but just blasting this song on my headphones and just appreciating the scenery and just like just enjoying all of the things that I had just had no idea about before. And now I just, this one has a special place in my heart.
Well, let's hope you go soon. It sounds like you're yearning to go.
I know you're inspiring me. I think I gotta book the trip soon.
You're inspiring me. Yeah. Okay, let's hear something from a local musician here in Los Angeles. Tell us about this next track.
Yeah, this is actually an artist that I first discovered through KCRW and Garth Trinidad over 10 years ago. His name is Omid Valizadeh, and he is a, you know, Iranian composer and producer, you know, that has a lot of hip-hop roots. He scored an Ava DuVernay documentary about the 90s hip-hop scene. And, you know, with me, he's kind of most recently caught my attention through some recent releases and albums where he's, you know, found a really great way to mash up classic Iranian music with really inventive, clever beats and transitions and so forth. He put together a remix, or basically a mixtape. It's called Golhaye Rang Orang, and which means an assortment of flowers. So it feels like it's very appropriate for all of the iconography of spring and this year. So here is Golhaye Rang Orang, the title track from Omid's mixtape.
Thank you.
های رنگارنگ گل های رنگارنگ گل های گل های گل های
That's a great one. Okay, so that means an assortment of flowers. And Nasir, I understand 7 is a magical number for this holiday. How does that manifest itself? And why 7?
Yes. Well, I think Iranians typically they're very superstitious. 7 is just a lucky number. And I think that's probably where that number comes from. But one of the big traditions for the Nowruz is called the Sofreya Hafsin, which is an arrangement of 7 symbolic items whose names start with a letter S. So sabze is probably the central part of these displays. It's sprouted grass, which is a symbol of growth and regrowth. And the New Year lasts for about 13 days. And again, because I mentioned how superstitious they are, on the 13th day, because they feel like 13 is an unlucky number, they have a tradition called Sizdavidar, where they go on the 13th day following the new year, and they go to the parks to do picnics and barbecues, and they take that sprouted grass and they throw them out. But it's really great to see how many different families and what they're able to do. It's like definitely a sense of pride when you get to see the different Sofreya Hafsins.
You know, it's interesting. It reminds me of a Seder plate. Also, which is, what you have in Passover, which is around the same time,
yes.
Right? It's also a spring ritual, spring holiday. And there are 6 or 7 items, 7 if you include matzah. But in the Jewish tradition, most of those ingredients represent misery, not happiness.
Yeah. There's, I think it's all about that change and the spring and just finding, like, they even have the beginning of the new year is this, and I'm sure you may have heard of this, but it's a day, it's the eve of the last Wednesday before the new year. It's called Charsham Besuri. So It's where a lot of Iranians, they gather around a bonfire. And again, you can make this a small candle, you can make it a huge flame and bonfire, but we all jump over the fire and we kind of, try and remove all of the, all of the sins or all the bad energy and trying to retain all of the great, beautiful red energy and warmth of the fire. So there's all about purging the old or anything that's not really, serving us anymore and bringing in something new. But absolutely a lot of similarities with a lot of different cultures, which is really interesting with the Persian New Year.
For sure. And, just to inject a little current events / politics into this conversation. There have been massive protests in Iran recently over women's rights. And so how does this year's celebration of Nowruz feel different in light of that?
Well, I think it's very powerful in a few different ways. It's a little bittersweet, I think, because while we have this opportunity for change, and that's kind of what this is all about, so there's this hope. There's also the fact that there's been a lot of lives that have been, affected by this, protest movement. And so some people are not able to be with, some of those loved ones, because if they're imprisoned or if they're no longer here or anything like that. So it's very much, I think it's going to be bittersweet. But again, I believe that it's even more powerful than ever, because with all the symbolism of change, I really hope that everything that has conspired is kind of moving us toward, again, having something more progressive, where people have more freedoms and are able to enjoy, some of the things we take for granted here.
Okay, well, let's go out on a song that could bring us some hope. The title of this next song translates to "The Spring Came." So tell us about this one.
Yeah, this is a track from Shervin Hajipour, who many of you may know as, because of during this Iranian protest movement. He is an Iranian hip-hop artist and singer, and he put together an incredible song called Baraye that, as we probably know, just won, incredibly, the Grammy Award for Best Song for Social Change. And it's just amazing, because there's a song that I want to share, again, called Bahar Omad, Spring Came, as you mentioned. And this was written a few years before it, but he's predicting in this song a future where hip-hop performers are playing at Milad Tower, which is one of the biggest sites in the capital of the country, and they don't worry about any police or anyone fleeing the country. They want the artist to stay in the homeland. So one of the lines, at least the translated lyrics, says, "The sky is cold and we are frozen, but the spring is coming and we're hearing its sound." So he really has this optimism that things will change, and yeah, it's a great way to just spring forward and just have this hope that things will change.
Yeah. Okay, this is a great song to go out on. Thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your culture, your music, and the history of Nowruz with us. I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much for being open to having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my immense pleasure. That's KCRW DJ Nasirzadeh. You can hear him Sundays from midnight to 3 a.m. right here on KCRW.
اون روزا میبینم که همه بچه های هیپ هاپ دارن کنسرت میذارن رو استیج میلاد انگا دوره باوره ولی میدونم آخرش این قصه قشنگ میشه اون روز میاد بیره دستا با
And that'll do it for us today. Happy spring. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.
میمونه تو وطن نمیرن رپر و فرنگ صدا بیت ناب میاد میشه تهران قشنگ دم در لابی پاک کادیلاک قرمز زیر زمینی ها گذاشتن اجرای زنده هرکی با عشق شد چی که عشق چی گوش میره جالبه هرکی یه شکله امید بوده تو دل این خونواده از قدیم و هر کجا که باشیم بازم تو دلامون با همین درد آسمونمون و یخ زده وجودمون بهار داره میاد اما ما صداشو میشنویم بهار اومد که گل ها رنگ و رنگ جونو بهار اومد که گل ها رنگ و رنگ جونو برای توی کوچه رخ سیدن برای ترسیدن به وقت بوسیدن برای خواهرم خواهرت خواهرامون برای تغییر مغزها که پوسیدن برای شرمندگی برای بی پولی برای حسرت یک زندگی معمولی برای کودک زبال گرد و آرزوهاش برای این اقتصاد دستوری برای این هوای آلوده برای ولی عصر و درخت های فرسوده برای پیر